COVID-19 patients need your help.
If you've fully recovered from COVID-19
or unknowingly been exposed to it,
you may have the antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients recover.
Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies.
Visit Vitalant.org today to schedule an appointment to donate blood.
That's Vitalant.org. Help save lives and schedule your appointment at Vitalant.org.
You could help save lives.
A different future starts with you. That's why GoDaddy does more than help you find a name. You can create, sell, and get found online so any small business can make a change. We need a new generation of thinking. Your way of thinking. Start different at GoDaddy.com.
This is an ode to the glass noodle. You may be glass only in name, but our love for you is crystal clear in every Bibigo Korean dumpling. Your tantalizing texture tickles the taste buds, and while you are see-through, the world can't help but see you. The glass noodle, one of many obsessively crafted ingredients in every plump and juicy Korean dumpling from Bibigo. Go handcrafted. Go Bibigo. Authentic Korean dumplings now in the freezer aisle.
This is Podco Media Networks.
It's the Innovation Podcast with Mark Reed Edwards and Garnett Harriman. Let's start the show.
Hi, it's Mark. Here we are with the final episode of our chat with Brad Barbera, founder and chief enabler of strategic innovation at Pi Innovation. Brad's based in Boise, Idaho, and we get a glimpse into what Boise's like and what it's like to watch football on that famous blue field. Oh, and we dig into entrepreneurs versus intrapreneurs. I bring up my favorite example of intrapreneurship. Garnett asks Brad about common startup CEO mistakes, and we take a glimpse into the future. Here we go. Let me just ask you about Boise and what living in Boise is like, and as an innovator, whether there are any lessons to be learned from living in a place that isn't on either of the coasts.
Well, increasingly, Boise is, at least some people are trying to make it part of the West Coast. It's one of the fastest growing cities in the country, and a lot of the people moving in are coming in from California, Portland, Seattle. It's becoming a tech hub, to be honest. And there's quite a few startups in the area. It's really an exciting time to be here. Just the city's changing. Even just the few years that I've lived here, I can kind of practically watch the change happening. More laid back, certainly, than the East Coast. It's just like a small town. It's like a big small town. You know, you've got just a different sense of community here than I think you have in a lot of the bigger cities.
Is there like a tech hub, a venture hub happening there? I know that there is in certain, it's either Utah or
yeah,
Idaho. I can't remember which one. But Boise doesn't come up on my list too much.
Yeah, but Boise's got Micron and HP here.
Nice.
And you know, in terms of like exciting innovation hubs, the company Simplot, which is basically it's a food company, but they provide the French fries for McDonald's, I believe. They just took it upon themselves to build this place called Jump. And it's a super cool innovation, creativity sort of lab where it's just kind of a central community hub for people who are feeling innovative and creative and doers and makers. And so, yeah, it's a cool town, and it's just getting cooler, I think.
So we were on a pretty interesting progression about this dichotomy between different types of insights leading to different kinds of innovation and different kinds of innovation being associated with different like corporate settings. And I'm also old enough to remember multiple incarnations of like innovation vehicles and multiple incarnations of this whole notion of an incubator, you know, going back to the mid-90s. And back in the late 90s, early 2000s, actually, my first investment group had a relationship with Boeing when Boeing was still in St. Louis. And the unit that we worked with specifically was called something like Intraventures. And ever since that novel phraseology, I've been fascinated by the difference between entrepreneurs and intrapreneurs, which is what they call
right.
They called their staffers, the Boeing staffers that were working on these, you know, moonshot type, innovation.
Right.
What's the difference between an entrepreneur and an entrepreneur?
It's fascinating that we share a similar experience. Again, back when I was at Kraft Foods, I became part of what they called Entrepreneurs Unlimited. It was kind of like corporations always have to have a cute name for everything, right?
Of course.
But it was a very educational experience in the sense of seeing what it's like to try to be entrepreneurial within a corporate setting. And I think the single biggest difference that you see between those entrepreneurs and the entrepreneurs is on that risk reward sort of scale. So when you're an entrepreneur, you're taking all the risk upon yourself. You then garner all the rewards.
Yes.
Google was invented inside of another corporation. Nobody would have been made a billionaire, multi-billionaire. You kind of cap things out when you're an entrepreneur.
Yep.
There are certainly rewards and recognition if you're successful, but the risk is lower too. Like if you're not successful, well, we'll just get into your previous career path. That's certainly the biggest thing that I think is the difference between the two. But the thing that I don't think people appreciate with regards to the difficulties of being an entrepreneur is what I like to call the corporate antibodies. And I'm taking that term from somebody else. I loved it. It's the kind of thing where as soon as somebody comes out and says, hey, I've got a new way of doing things, all these antibodies come out of the woodwork and attack and say, no, you will submit. You will die. Go away. We're going to do it the same way we've always done it. And with an entrepreneurial situation, you've got a lot of that to deal with. And I mentioned the serial innovators before, and those people are really these entrepreneurs in a way. And there's a fantastic book that kind of talks about serial innovators and how they think, but it provides some biographical sketches. And some of these people who created these billion-dollar businesses for their companies were almost fired. And they were almost fired because they didn't fit. They didn't want to fit. They were trying to do something new and different and creative. And those corporate antibodies were attacking them and trying to just get them out. We don't want you here. And those multi-billion-dollar businesses would never have been created had the antibodies won. So there's a special need to manage these people in a way that shields them from the corporate antibodies. And I know, like you mentioned, Boeing and Lockheed Martin is famous for their skunk works. And I think you need something like that, some sort of structure within an organization that allows these entrepreneurs to be safeguarded while they are developing these businesses. And with an entrepreneur, you don't need that. They're on their own and they're just making it happen. And they have their own challenges. When you're an entrepreneur, you've got your funding coming from the company and it's relatively secure. With an entrepreneur, you don't know where your funding's going to come from. You got to constantly be out hustling and pitching and trying to get those funds so you can develop and scale. So it's very different, but those entrepreneurs, they have a hardship that I don't think a lot of people recognize.
I've seen different permutations of the core model that entrepreneurship model that you're referring to, and certain companies have, I guess you'd call it a spin out option, right, or a spin off option, wherein the entrepreneur who is nurturing an opportunity that, God willing, would become a billion-dollar opportunity is allowed to essentially go with the opportunity into like an external venture that then can leverage all of the resources that are in the external market, capital being just one of them. And there are different degrees of umbilical cords that are maintained between the corporate sponsor, and the external spin out, and different ways to do that. But I feel like that's a fairly nimble approach to sort of blending the two models. But not every corporation is that nimble, though.
That is very true. Sometimes you have, I like to talk about subcultures, and sometimes you'll have like one group that, maybe they have that manager that's able to shield them and allow them to operate freely while simultaneously reporting back to the organization that kind of everything's okay. Let us keep going. We'll be fine. you can develop those little bubbles of entrepreneurship, but it's hard. It is really difficult.
The one entrepreneurship example that I always think of is the creation of the Post-it note by 3M, by a couple of scientists who had kind of similar ideas and met and created the Post-it note.
Yeah, it's a great story of perseverance in the face of being told no many times. One of the things I admire most about that is even the people who invented it and were the ones who were out trying to make it happen, if you look at their story at the very beginning, they didn't really realize what they had.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they didn't think of all the applications that it could have. They were like, oh, it's a book note that a bookmark that doesn't fall out of the book. Like, big deal. But they knew it had potential.
Yeah.
And the willingness and the courage it took to be able to persevere against all the no's. You got an adhesive that doesn't stick? Wait a minute.
Yeah.
It makes no sense at all. Why would you bother going after that? But obviously look at the impact it made.
Yeah, sometimes the obvious thing is just not obvious until you get other people involved and the idea iterates.
Exactly. They did a good job of observing. We were talking about insights before, and they were observing when they just handed out some samples, you know, how did people use these? And it was in ways that they wouldn't come up with themselves. And I think that's real good testament of why you need to be out there with your customers, allowing them to try things, working with them, you know, seeing how they interact with your products, rather than a very common innovator mistake is to just say, oh, I have this idea. It is the right idea. And I'm going to go make that happen.
If you've recovered from COVID-19 or unknowingly been exposed to it, you may have antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients. Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies. Visit Vitalant.org today.
I'm curious what you think is the biggest mistake startup CEOs make.
Very much along the lines of what I was just talking about. I think people will get too attached to their product, and that causes them to make two mistakes. One is they don't think of it as a business. They think only in terms of this product, and they get married to the product that they're trying to create. They become blind to customer feedback. I'll tell a quick story about when I was working for one company, we had external innovators come in and allowed them to pitch ideas to us. And I won't go into what the product was, but one guy had this idea, and it involved, for the customer to use it, they would have to actually drill holes in their furniture. And I just brought up to him what I would hope is obvious to all of us here. Nobody wants to drill holes in their furniture. Like, you don't destroy your living room furniture for the sake of an add-on product. He literally looked me in the eye and said, nope, I've thought of this. It is the right way to attach it. And I let it go. I don't know anybody that ever picked up. But that's the kind of mindset they get in. They're so focused on their product that they forget to make it a business. That also translates into, you know, they might have a cool initial product idea, but they need a whole product line to be able to make a business. And they don't think through those steps. They don't think about, you know, sales channels. How am I going to get this into the hands of a customer? They kind of have the belief in that adage, you know, build a better mousetrap and the world will beat a path to your door. And nothing could be further from the truth. Like, you really have to work, no matter how good the product is, no matter how much better it is than previous solutions, you've got to work to get it into people's hands, to get them to trust that, you know, it's worth the risk of purchase. The cost of customer acquisition is just something that people don't think of nearly enough. And it costs them a lot in creating a new business.
That's a great insight. Yeah. Think about your products as a business and work backwards. I've heard permutations of that I really like. Let me run one by you. Think of that moment in time where your customer is like delighted, you know, where they have this moment of sheer joy and delight over your whatever the widget is that you just sold that person. Work backwards from there. I've heard different tellings of that same piece of advice that the delight one is something that I heard fairly recently, and I'm sort of amused by it.
Yeah, I love that. Taking that kind of approach really resonates. It reminds whoever's trying to think through these problems that they really need to be in the heart and soul of their customer.
Yep.
And not just kind of like, you know, well, you need a bigger widget or you need your widget in blue rather than green. That tends to be, we get focused on the product, we get focused on the solution, and we forget about the, I love that word, delight. Like, you know, that's really, that's getting into somebody's heart.
I heard that from a techie, like a hardcore like coder talking about products that he was working on. And I was like, huh. That's so weird. Sometimes when things ring, when they sound strange to your ears, at the same time, you know that there's some deep truth behind it. That's sort of a weird feeling, right?
That strikes me. That person's got that pie-shaped mind we were talking about, because they're not just in the technical realm. They're understanding that customer need.
Might be. Yeah, it could be
going very deep.
One of those very special thinkers, and I'll explain this to you offline more, Brad, but this is going to be a little fun inside joke for Mark. This is the person who said that to me and was so insightful by Brad's own admission and my own admission. It's someone that Mark doesn't want to do business with.
Oh, jeez.
And I know Mark knows exactly who I'm talking about, but we won't mention him on the air.
But on that, I agree with him or her.
Of course.
Delight is what you're after as a brand.
I wasn't trying to be critical of Mark or the person in question. I was suggesting that there are personality consequences for that type of deep, wide-ranging thinking.
And I will do business.
Very
with,
true.
I will do business with pretty much anyone. So just putting that out there.
But just for the record. So this is the part of the we're going to start winding up, but this is really the part of the podcast that Mark and I enjoy a lot. True blue sky, pie in the sky type stuff. So we want to open up the conversation to you, Brad, about any future predictions you have, whether it's about the future of mayonnaise or the future of
all right, yes, the future of mayonnaise.
The Super Bowl or
mayonnaise is definitely in my past, so I don't know the future of mayonnaise.
Well, I, for one, am very sad that a great mind like yours is not working on mayonnaise, because I am a fan of mayonnaise. But
well, you never know. It may happen again. And now that I know there's some passionate need for it out there in the marketplace, which I never imagined, maybe I will revisit it.
But I also want to know, Brad, what it's like to watch football on a blue field live and in person.
It is great. It is the best. And I will be the first to admit I was a big skeptic. So I live in Boise, where Boise State plays their football on a blue turf. And when I first moved out here, all I wanted to do was go to one game just to see that god-awful turf. And now that I'm here, I go there and I, as they say around here, we bleed blue. It's just... such a great experience. So yeah, I really recommend it. So thinking about the future, one of the things I have learned in my decades of innovation work is not to make predictions, because I'm always wrong.
What a cop out.
I won't cop out. I will go ahead and make a prediction. And,
thank you.
And I've thought a lot about this lately. I think that the future, particularly when it comes to innovation, is that we're going to see a big increase in compassion when it comes to innovation. We just got done talking about this person thinking about, how do I delight my consumer? And that's kind of a form of compassion. And I think we are in a world that is changing faster all the time. We talked about the VUCA world. Change is hard for everybody, and nobody wants to change, and yet change is imposed upon them all the time. And when you look at the future with like AI and robotics and things where the material world is going to replace a lot of the human world as we know it, particularly in the professions, we are going to need a lot of compassion to understand how to help those people who are displaced by innovation. And the innovations can be wonderful and they can truly make the world a better place. But you think about Schumpeter's concept of creative destruction, you know, that involves some destruction. And there are going to be people who don't benefit from some of these things. And we have to find a way to make the changes that are happening inclusive and compassionate for those people who may not have immediate benefit. I hear a lot of talk, at least, about retraining programs or help with job loss and stuff. And those are kind of getting at that technical solution, and they're not getting at the heart. You know, and how do we delight these people? How do we make people say, like, yeah, I lost my job to AI. That means I get to go do something better. You know, that's kind of where I truly believe that the more innovative and the more thoughtful people in the world who are trying to figure out ways to solve problems for humanity, they're going to be drawn to that compassion component. We're going to see some really cool passion-based innovation in the future. And that's my prediction, and I'm sticking with it.
I love it. That's absolutely great. Love it. And, you know, with the rise of impact, everything, impact investing, impact entrepreneurship and innovation, and social venture, social entrepreneurship being such a major theme in the world at large, especially the investment world, it would be hard to bet against you, Brad. maybe this is a great place to start winding up. We're speaking with Brad Barbera, a lifelong, I would say, certainly career-long innovator and innovation pro, and by far my most favorite mayonnaise engineer in the world currently.
Thank you.
Not
Thank
working you. In the I, field.
it's great to top a list like that.
Thank you so much for being with us, Brett.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I've really enjoyed the discussion and wish you guys well with this podcast. It's a good one.
Thanks for joining Garnett and Mark on the Innovation Podcast. Visit the innovationpodcast.co to subscribe and listen to other episodes.